Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Hussain. I'll be here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, 500 Toronto students participate in the annual Walk with Excellence.
Feels like we're facing the actual world, the actual reality. It's like waking up from the high school dream.
The Ontario government is showing signs it's backing away from its proposal to allow residential construction on farmland.
We're pleased that they hit pause, but we really want to make sure that they hit delete.
This as the Six Nation Farmers Association forms a task force to counter lack of farming.
There's no more important time now than to start to grow our own food.
BC composer Wiley Ferguson has his piece, A Broken Earth, debut with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra.
Gratifying, satisfying to hear something that I've put so much time and work into, and it's something that I've been wanting to do since I was a teenager. I think that just the whole experience, I was just excited to be able to be there.
And Canadian filmmaker Colin Askey talks about his latest documentary film, Love in the Time of Fentanyl.
It's a place filled with misfits and outcasts and beautiful people that were doing whatever it took to come together and to try and improve the lives of their loved ones.
And in New Brunswick, the Performers Theatre Company is back with a new play, while Quebec's Theatre Lake Brome showcases more English plays. This and more on Viewpoints.
Local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for being with us. Is there still love in the midst of the fentanyl crisis? That's the question film director Colin Askey is trying to answer in his latest documentary film, Love in the Time of Fentanyl. In 2016, in the midst of the newly declared public health emergency in British Columbia, known as the overdose crisis, self-described Renegade Safe Injection Site Overdose Prevention Society, or OPS, began operating in Vancouver's downtown east side, DTES, to provide several safe places where users can test their drugs, get needles, inject safely, and access various services. In his film, Love in the Time of Fentanyl, director Colin Askey follows the OPS team as they continue to save lives daily. Askey talks with BC journalist James Mingy from his home in New York City about his motivations for the film.
Now, Love in the Time of Fentanyl, I know that's it's been around, I think it made its debut last year at the Doxa Festival here in Vancouver. But if we could go back a little bit further, and can you tell us how this project originally started?
Yeah, for sure. So I worked in the downtown east side for many years before moving to New York in 2016. You know, that was right around the time that kind of fentanyl had taken over the drug supply. So my wife also worked in the neighborhood. We're getting calls almost weekly at some points, hearing about people that, you know, we'd known that were passing away, and knowing the friends that were working in the neighborhood that we're just going through hell. And I remember watching the news at the time, and it really kind of focused on how hard this crisis was on the paramedics. You know, the community members themselves were the kind of the first responders that were teaching themselves to use naloxone and reverse overdoses, and caring for their friends and loved ones weren't getting, I felt like, you know, a light shined on them. So that's what I really wanted to capture. And I didn't know, you know, what I was going to do. I was doing a few different projects at the time. And when I met Sarah, you know, I'd known her for many years from my previous time working there, and known lots of folks that work there, like Sarah and Ronnie and Norma. It just seemed like a real opportunity to really get what I was looking for. And I think that place really, you know, represented the neighborhood for me in a lot of ways. You know, it's a place filled with misfits and outcasts and beautiful people that were doing whatever it took to come together and to try and improve the lives of their loved ones. And you know, like, there obviously a lot of tragedy in the neighborhood outside of that space, but inside it's filled with a lot of love, and that's what I was hoping to capture.
And by Sarah, I'm guessing you mean Sarah Blythe, the woman who I think she founded and runs the Overdose Prevention Society. Is that right?
Yeah, I first met her, I think, in around 2011, and I'd known her well and had a lot of respect for her. And, you know, hearing from a distance of what was happening in the neighborhood, it was really horrible and sad, but also just really inspiring and beautiful to see the lengths that people were going to respond when really no one else outside of the community knew what to do.
Yeah, maybe it's worth reminding our listeners that I think 2016, the date you're referring to, that's when the overdose crisis was officially declared a health emergency by the province of British Columbia. So it's staggering to believe that it's been going on for 7 years, and I don't know, it just doesn't really seem to be getting any better, does it?
I mean, I've been back to Vancouver like a few times a year, and it just seems like a real, real hopeless situation, a frustrating situation. You know, I think like from when I started this, people in the community were really kind of screaming, you know, safe supply and different options. I think ops was such a beautiful example of that. Sometimes you got to break the rules to save lives and do what's right. I think the Downtown East Side has historically done that over and over again.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the actual film now. Can you sort of give us a brief overview, maybe a quick synopsis? I don't want to give too much away, of course. I encourage people to go see the film. But, basically, what does the film chronicle?
Film just basically takes us inside the space, inside the Overdose Prevention Society. And it's filmed completely observational, so there's no interviews or anything. You know, as I was filming, you know, I'd worked at Insight and I'd worked in these spaces before. And so that's what I was hoping to capture, because there's a lot of misunderstanding and strong feelings towards these kind of services. So I wanted to give people, you know, a chance to kind of walk along the journey of these frontline workers. You know, we follow Sarah, we follow Ronnie, who's a manager there at the time, and a lot of people, you know, that are active and former drug users that work at this place, just as a day in the life and inside of what it's like to be on the front lines and what is, you know, fairly known globally as ground zero of this crisis there in the Downtown East Side. It's where, yeah, I think we see like Ronnie's character as he struggles with burnout. We see Sarah, she's, you know, trying to, keep the doors open and get the message outside of the neighborhood of what this crisis is really like for those living inside it, and kind of get people on board to really make some drastic changes. We see Trey, who's, you know, he's an artist, and a lot of, there's a bit of Smokey D in there, who's well known in the neighborhood, you know, and trying to spread the message through graffiti and painting walls about what's going on in the neighborhood. And we see a guy named Dana, who's a real intelligent sweetheart, who is also active injection drug user. And he is saving lives and also struggling with his own addiction, and he goes to treatment. He struggles trying to come off fentanyl. It's also, we see that with Dana, and we see an amazing woman named Norma, who's like, one of the sweetest souls I've had the honor of meeting in my life. I've known her for many years, and she really just cares about the Downtown East Side. She's an Indigenous elder who was able to stop using heroin. She still, you know, drinks and smokes crack. She is, you know, one of the kindest people I've ever met. And she cooks meals for the staff there and just really works at trying to build that community in that place that makes it so special.
That was Colin Lasky, the director of Love in the Time of Fentanyl.
Thanks to James Mengi. Listen to the complete half-hour interview on canada-info.ca.
Hello, I'm Andrew Dow in Six Nations, Ontario. You are tuned in to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
The Ontario government has taken a step back from measures that would allow 3 residential dwellings to be built per lot on farmlands across the province. Ontario is not yet saying it's cancelling the project, but it's extending the commenting period for the proposed provincial planning statement to August. The decision comes as Doug Ford's government is under pressure from farmers and agricultural organizations across the province. More with Riley Gillespie-Wilson in Fergus, Ontario.
The Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing stated they have extended the consultation period on the proposed provincial planning statement to give the public an enhanced opportunity to provide feedback. The period will now end in early August. Janet Hara, president of the Wellington Federation of Agriculture, says while they are happy the province has made the decision, there is still work to be done.
Federation of Agriculture is very pleased that the government listened to the farm organizations and all the commodity groups and pressed pause on the proposal to allow 3 residential lots on farmland. We're pleased that they hit pause, but we really want to make sure that they hit delete.
She reminds people that Wellington County is a hub of sorts for agricultural production that must be protected.
We have to be really cognizant of the fact that we can't pave over this highly fertile soil, because that soil is what feeds the people that live in Ontario. So this is a foundational resource for agriculture and food sovereignty.
Harrop continued to say if farmers could sell to developers or had building lots on farms, these building lots would have short-term economic gain. She says in the long term, it would be almost impossible to build a livestock facility or expand. I'm Riley Gillespie-Wilson.
As the Ontario government seems to be ready to sacrifice some farmland to residential development, the Six Nations Farmer Association in Ontario, SNFA, has launched a task force to look for ways to contend with the lack of farming in the community. On June 5th, the task force asked the Six Nations elected council to support a food sustainability and security program that would allow for more community members to be educated in agriculture. The project would bring both an agricultural resource center and a community-run grocery store to Six Nations. More with Andrew Dow in Oshawakin, Ontario.
The group outlined the program, which would see the creation of the Six Nations Food Sustainability Task Force and begin operations under it. Ruby Jacobs, secretary for the task force, spoke to the lack of farmers within the Six Nations community and the group's hope to revitalize the sector with the program.
And everywhere, farmers' farming is decreasing, even across the country. In our data that we've collected, individual farming is slowly decreasing. It's more the corporate level farming that's happening. So their vision is to try and revitalize safe and healthy farming in the community.
She said the program was developed after the Farmers Association surveyed the community to get an understanding of what was thought about agriculture within Six Nations. She said the group is currently looking to buy 10 acres of land for the development of the grocery store, and that the current construction budget being proposed for the building will be around $5.6 million. Six Nations Chief Mark Hill spoke to the importance of having food security for the community and said he looks forward to continuing to support this project in the future.
I think it's quite important, especially with what we've learned, over COVID times. There's no more important time now than to start to grow our own food is at this point. So, again, do also appreciate all the work that has gone into this presentation and project, and do look forward to how we could further support this as a whole.
Councillor Sherry Lynn Hill says she would like to see this project not only focus on food security and sustainability within Six Nations, but also look to capitalize on federal grants and programs to further benefit Six Nations.
This can be really a big endeavor if we really wanted it to be.
Jesse Porter, one of the task force directors, says he would like to have all contributing parties gather in the near future to form a summit to discuss these issues and to have them analyze what the needs are here on Six Nations specifically.
Through all of this, we have to look at how each of us play a part in assisting in this, because there's enough room for everybody to be involved in this. It's going to be a struggle to figure out how we do come together. And one of the things that come to my mind is this fancy word that globally they use, and it's called a summit, to be able to sit together and look at the strategies that each of us could bring to the table.
Chief Hill says it's exciting time seeing the program being developed, and says it's important that all collaborators on this project work together to ensure its success.
I think it's exciting times as we assist, and do this really as a community. I think that's going to be the key, in terms of making sure that this is a success, is that we have all collaborators at the table.
Six Nations elected council passed the motion and agreed to provide a band council resolution in principle support of the project to the Six Nations Food Sustainability Task Force to further assist in the next steps of the program.
Hello, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
500 graduating high school students from four different schools around the Toronto area proudly participated in the 10th annual Walk with Excellence. Students marched from C.W. Jeffries Collegiate Institute to York University. The march is a kind of graduation event where faculty, personnel, students, and community members walk side by side to celebrate the students' transition from high school to their future endeavors. But it's also much more than that. For the students, it's a very important step and ritual. Owen Thompson is in Toronto, Ontario. He met up with some of them.
Coming to the university, like, we walked from a secondary school and then we went to a university. It was like a glimpse of what it's like a transition in our lives. It feels like we're facing the actual world, the actual reality. It's like waking up from the high school dream.
The walk, when first started, was to celebrate the students in high-density areas for their accomplishments and continues to do such, says Ita Sadu, co-owner of the Blackhurst Cultural Center and organizer of the Walk with Excellence. Sadu has been organizing this walk for the entire 10 years of its existence. Her hope was to change the narrative around high-density areas.
Young people and students, sometimes in high-density neighborhoods, don't get the credit that is due to them. And sometimes people forget that greatness comes from all places and spaces. So repeatedly in media, whether it be print or electronic, you just kept getting the same one story, one narrative of like the Jane and Finch community in a high density neighborhood. If you tell people the same thing over and over, they will believe it. Black boys don't read. They do. Black people don't read. They do. Black people don't engage in education. They've done that since Timbuktu. So when you keep saying things over and over and over again, Jane and Finch is probably the most famous intersection in the country. What does Canadians know about the community? I'm pretty sure it is not a very positive and popular narrative. And so generation after generation, people get saddled with this, while at the same time, we've seen all the folks who have come through the community who have gone on to excel in so many ways, not just in their professions as in medicine and agriculture and whatever, but as family and as parents.
After coming to the idea of a march, they went to the local high schools and asked the students in the parking lot if there was a parade for them, would they go? Sadu says that they received an overwhelming but skeptical yes from the student body. After they went to the schools themselves, Sadu says that they liked the idea as well, enough to help organize it.
Because at the end of the day, it's a day for them. It's not against violence. It's not against failing. It's not against crime. It's not against none of those things. It's simply a day to celebrate them. So it was important to have student voice, to get their permission. Something can't be planned for students in Jane and Finch for them simply to enjoy. And they don't have to be workshopped to death and surveyed to death and all these different things that sometimes people seem to put through working class people in order to appreciate them.
Actors Ben Hébert and Faith Higgins will star in Stanton's Garage, which is on until June 24th at the Performers Theatre Company space in Sackville, New Brunswick. Stanton's Garage is part reflection on life and part comedy of errors. Erica Butler spoke with Faith Higgins and Ben Hébert.
It's a bit of a play that's hard to define, but it's there's kind of two main strands to it. It's set in this garage, which is in the middle of nowhere, sort of this run-down, locally owned garage. And it's about pretty much when your life gets upturned and you kind of just have a moment to sit and are almost forced to reflect on it. It kind of explores that. That's the first half. And then the second half is a comedy of errors. You know, you really want something to get done, but the people who work there are just completely incompetent and will not get it done. So it has this sort of personal, introspective, reflective side to it.
Sounds relatable coming out of the pandemic, where we all sort of had that moment of like, wait, what are we doing? What are our lives?
Yeah, exactly. And one thing we've been talking about too is the garage. It's a garage that we've all been in, especially in like rural New Brunswick. It's this, you know, you're just driving on the road and you just see it on the side there and you're like, wow.
Yeah, awesome. And we are very grateful because one of the actors in our show, her dad runs a local garage here. So we were able to like pull just a bunch of random junk that he's just had lying around for like 10, 20 years in order to make our set look just identical to his. And we had a day where we went in with just like a bunch of dirt and like old junk, and we just made the whole place look like really gross but authentic. Like, you look at the set and you can see where the like high touch areas are, because someone went in with like wax to make it look like someone's been like pushing on the door for 20 years, and you're like, wow, this is nasty, but you can't actually, like, there's no health hazard yet.
Yeah.
And to the province of Quebec, where Theatre Lake Brome has partnered up with Montreal-based theatre company Infinitheatre to bring English theatre productions to the eastern townships of Quebec. Lake Brome Theatre has a long history of putting on summer plays and providing an equal amount of entertainment and cultural opportunities to the English-speaking and French-speaking communities of Brome Lake. But it has recently faced challenges in finding an English theatre company in the province which tours with its productions. Zach Fraser, artistic director of Infinitheatre, said the partnership with TLB couldn't have come at a better time. Taylor McClure speaks with Fraser, as well as Anne Dubé, artistic director of Theatre Lake Brome.
To find a play that would tour around Quebec was a bit more challenging for the English version side. I reached out to companies in Montreal, and then our president, Jean-Claude, reached out to Zach for Infinite Theater because we heard about their production. So that's why we reached out to them to see, hey, would this be possible for us to partnership with you? And we could bring each year, because they do production each year. We have like a 50-50% French people speaking and English community. So it's important to me to be able to do as much English shows that I do French show. People from Lac Brome has a big history with Lac Brome being a theater that used to produce summer plays. They're really asking a lot for us to continue this tradition to present some plays at the theater.
We were already thinking more broadly or vaguely along the same lines in that we're based in Montreal. We have a history of developing new works, but also always trying to find new ways to extend the lives of the productions we put so much into. So I took over as artistic director at Infinite Theatre a couple of years ago, and one of the things that I really wanted to do was to make sure that we could find new ways to extend life and touring opportunities. We tend to do 2 to 3 productions a year, and I said, you know, let's try to aim to have 1 or 2 of those pieces that are tourable in some capacity. So when folks at Lac Brome reached out to us, it was, you know, we were already in the same mindset.
And we closed the show with composer Wiley Ferguson, who showcased his new composition with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra this spring. Ferguson's 6-minute piece is titled Broken Earth, and VSO played his composition on May 30th. The 30-year-old composer from British Columbia is very pleased about how it turned out. He describes the composition as monster music. All this because Ferguson applied last September to the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra's composition mentorship program. He was accepted and began the 7-month program last October. Here's some of Ferguson's Broken Earth composition and his reflections on the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra membership program in this interview with Craig Osoba.
Wiley Ferguson applied last year to the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra's composition mentorship program, was accepted, and began writing a piece that would debut with the VSO at the end of May this year. Ferguson is based in Nanaimo, where he teaches music and guitar. His parents live on Cortez Island. He's influenced by many modern-day composers, both in the classical and jazz genres, including Bertolt Brecht and Frank Zappa. What makes him unique is that he has his foot in a wide range of musical styles, all the way from death metal and jazz to contemporary classical music. The VSO played his composition, Broken Earth, at the end of May, and he's very pleased with how it all went and what he has learned during the process.
It went just as good or better than I expected it to. I feel like I put in a lot of work into the piece that I wrote, and yeah, they played great. I got a lot of good feedback, and it was a good learning experience, and yeah, I feel very happy with the results, for sure.
All
right. Now, you just said you had learned a lot from this whole experience. It began last fall when, for lack of a better description, I think, Wiley, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was like an apprenticeship in composition with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra. What did you feel like you learned since last fall and then from when the piece debuted at the end of May?
Yeah, it was like the format that they had going is basically a mentorship program. So we had master classes. I did them over Zoom, but some people are all in Vancouver. But they had a couple composers come in and talk about their approach to writing for orchestra, and a couple of the players, the symphony players, talked to us about just do's and don'ts about formatting parts and writing within the means of this performance. Maybe with a piece that has lots of rehearsal time, you can get away with a little bit more, but these are some of the best players that you're ever going to find in general. Some of the other pieces I felt were pretty ambitious, and they pulled it off pretty well. So I think that I was worrying in my previous experience with composing. I've had times where I write something that's maybe a little ambitious, and it doesn't come off the way that you want it to, just because it's difficult. You're not always going to be able to just nail those difficult passages right away. So it takes time and patience to rehearse those parts. But anyway, so that being said, like they talked about what you can write and the level of professionalism of the orchestra and how to talk to the orchestra and how all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Just describe what it felt like when you're sitting there and you're hearing your piece, which you've been hearing in your mind, of course, all this time during the composition process, but to hear it full on with an orchestra being played, what did it feel like?
At first, kind of stressful, to be honest. The first run through, they just go for it. The first run through, and then you have some time to adjust some things, and then another run through the piece, and that's pretty much it. So I would say the feeling of the first run through, I was just still a little nervous to hear how it was. Is my balance going to be okay between the different parts? Is everything going to come out okay? Was there anything that's too fast? But then the second run through, I just put the score away and just listened and enjoyed myself, because I don't think that opportunity happens too often. So I just was trying to slow down a bit and just enjoy it. But I would say, like, it's really, I don't know, gratifying, satisfying to hear something that I've put so much time and work into, and it's something that I've been wanting to do since I was a teenager. I think that just the whole experience, I was just excited to be able to be there.
Sounds like a dream come true.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely is. I've been thinking about that moment being hearing you for. I've been thinking about that for a lot of years. It's pretty exciting, to say the least, to be able to hear it.
Thanks again so much, Wiley, and congratulations on this tremendous accomplishment with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah, thanks a lot for saying that. I'm flattered, but I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and everything.
And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Our reporters this week, Craig Osoba, Andrew Dow, Erica Butler, Taylor McClure, Ryan Gillespie-Wilson, Owen Thompson, and James Mingy. National editors Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for keeping us company. Until next week, ciao.